Court is ready to hear argument in 050558, Reliance National Indemnity Company versus Advanced Temporary.
This appeal presents a statutory interpretation question of first impression for this court. Namely, under what circumstances, if any, does a temporary employment agency furnish labor under a contract with the meaning of Section 53.021A of the Property Code so that it's entitled to assert a mechanics lien?
What about furnishing the employees to a general contractor? Why isn't that enough?
Well, you have to, under all the courts that have examined this question, you have to do, what is it, the courts look in depth, what does it mean to provide the worker? And the standards that the courts have applied that have addressed this question, what they look at is whether the temporary employment agency has assumed the full legal responsibilities of being an employer. And what the California Court of Appeals and New York's highest court did in the tri-state case, which the Court of Appeals followed in this case, is they adopted a seven-factor, very fact-specific test to determine whether a temporary agency, or whatever you call it, whether somebody who provides workers for a fee, whether they're actually the true employer, whether they're actually furnishing labor, either under the surety bond or under the mechanics lien statute. Your Honor, I'd like to go back. I mean, this is an important statutory construction question to the construction industry, and obviously the temporary employment industry. And although I understand the court has issued cases that say that the statute should be construed liberally for the protection of laborers, first, before you're entitled to that liberal construction, I would submit that you have to show, indeed, you are a laborer or a furnisher of labor. And I think you ought to look to see what the legislature has done in this area, because a mechanics lien is a very powerful weapon.
It's a good weapon. It prevents someone from getting hosed on cost that they incur when they pay a general contractor, or the general contractor doesn't pay the provider of the employee. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, general contractor could always walk if this temporary employment agency can't find a way to protect itself.
I agree. It's a very important statute, and I'm not suggesting that this court do anything to change its traditional interpretation of the statute. But it also needs to recognize that it is a powerful weapon. And even if a small lien is filed, that basically puts an owner in default on its construction financing, and it subjects the property to the risk of loss in a foreclosure proceeding. And that's why I believe
that's why you have the surety bond, though, isn't it? Isn't that why a surety bond is filed to protect the parties from that?
That's correct. That's one of the reasons, and that's why we have a mechanics lien statute to protect the workers. But what I'm trying to get to is that the legislature passed a False Liens Recording Act in Chapter 12 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code. And it basically created a new statutory action that if you file a false lien, you know, you're entitled to a cause of action, and a $10,000 penalty is imposed even if you're not able to prove any damages. And so what I'm saying that in approaching this statute, you need to recognize that the legislature is very concerned that mechanics liens be properly interpreted and applied. But let me get to what the Court of Appeals did in this case. And a lot of what it did was right, and we agree with. The Court of Appeals rightly recognized for purposes of the mechanics lien statute there should be a distinction between an agency that principally provides administrative services and financing for payroll and insurance and an agency that takes upon itself the full legal responsibilities of the employer. And to determine whether a particular agency furnished labor, the Court of Appeals adopted a seven-factor test that was taken directly from a California Court of Appeals and a New York's highest court decision in Tri-State Employer Services. What I'd like to ask the court to do is take a look at the handout I provided the court. And what I want to discuss with the court, what I see are problems, some of the shortcomings and problems in the application of the seven-factor test. that this court needs to step in and clarify and modify. The first problem with this seven-factor test adopted by the Court of Appeals is that the test is incomplete. And what I would suggest that this court do is do what the New York Court of Appeals did in Tri-State. What the New York Court of Appeals recognized that in most cases, in the general case, staff, leasing companies, or personnel agencies really are not performing furnishing labor. What they're doing is providing payroll financing and providing human resource services. And so the New York Court said that there ought to be presumption that they're not furnishing labor and that they're not entitled to a claim under the bond or the lien. But it also recognized that presumption could be overcome if there was evidence that the temporary agency exercised significant direction and control over the worksite employees. And then it crafted the seven-factor test in order to do that, which was adopted by the Court of Appeals in this case. And what I'd like this court to do is to carefully examine, I think that there are four of these seven factors that are not clearly defined enough, that the trial courts are going to have real difficulty in interpreting these factors and applying them in a consistent way. And the first two factors that this court should look at are what involvement did the agency have in selecting and screening the workers for hire, and did the agency use its own criteria for hiring the workers? Well, the test tells the trial court it needs to look at those factors, but it doesn't tell the trial court what criteria they should use for hiring. How much selecting or screening should they use?
Well, why are those factors even relevant? I mean, if you're asserting a control test, wouldn't those be indications of level of control as opposed to, if there's no control, do those factors have any significance?
Well, if Your Honor is suggesting that there has to be ongoing control by the temporary employment agency, both at the beginning and during the relation and supervision, then I agree. If
there's
not evidence of that, you don't even get to the seven-factor test.
Right.
I'm not clear why. Who were? Doesn't make any difference how many factors we have. We need to know what we're trying to protect here. That's not what's clear. It's not clear to me what we're trying to protect and what does not deserve protection.
Well, and which is sort of where I was going with the control piece. My understanding from the briefing is that the reason you want to hinge it on control is because if the contractor has a claim they want to assert based on the work that's performed, you want them to be able to assert it against the lien holder, right? And since there's no contractual relationship between the temporary employment agency here, the general contractor can't sue the temporary employment agency for defective work unless there's control sufficient to make the temporary agency liable.
Your Honor, I'm not sure the Texas law is really clear on that point, that particular point. But Justice Heck, in response to you, the mechanics lien statute is designed, obviously, to perform a common worker, the guy that's out there working on the job. And the statute envision is also entitled to protect subcontractors and contractors. That's clear. Now, this is a new development. If a temp agency is going to be entitled to this powerful weapon, the mechanics lien, it ought to at least be assuming the full legal responsibilities that an employer, that a subcontractor, would be assuming in this position.
And the AGC says that this happens sometimes, that there are labor subcontractors. You saw that in the amicus brief.
Right.
If you're just supplying the labor and somebody else is directing the employees what to do, how can you assume responsibility for defects in the building?
Well, they would need, if they were the employer, there would be a respondeat superior.
Well, but you're not suing Joe Blow because he put the nails in wrong. Usually you're saying this is the subcontractor did bad work.
Right. Well, that's the point of the policy on this, is that the temporary employment agency isn't going to assume legal responsibility for the quality of the work.
But you think they're
on the job, they're not responsible.
It just seemed to me odd.
They shouldn't be entitled to the mechanics lien.
It seemed to me odd in the AGC's brief, page 4, that there are labor subcontractors, and they go out and all they do is provide employees, but they somehow take responsibility for the work. And I just wondered how that worked.
I'm afraid I can't give you any more help on that. But what I think, in trying to define these factors more fully, what I think the court ought to provide as a guiding principle is that and it's on my handout, the agency should have sufficient involvement in the screening of the workers and in establishing the hiring criteria that is to ensure its workers are capable of performing competent and safe construction work. And I give you a couple of examples of what I suggest at a minimum that it ought to require. These are things that, you know, any subcontractor would do if it was trying to hire a worker, screen a worker, and apply hiring criteria. It obtained the worker's prior work experience, certifications, wage rate, job references, and then it would go back and call the employers and verify the information.
Well, what if you just need a day laborer, and I have a day laborer camp with people that are here legally, and you are building a house, and you say, look, I need some workers. You pay me. I said, take any 10 you want. I got 100 here. And then they go perform the work just like this, except I'm not a temporary agency. This is my job, provide you day labor. Something goes wrong, you pay. I don't get paid. Why can't I assert a lien against what you benefited from, which would be the work performed by those laborers?
Well, unless you're showing that you are accepting the full responsibilities, first, to make sure that employee is qualified, that he's able to do the work, and second, that he has proper safety training. Because the construction industry is a very hazardous industry.
Yeah, I have been in the construction industry. It didn't take much to lift a wheelbarrow and push it down a ramp.
No, it doesn't. In our particular facts, it wasn't just day laborers. I mean, there were skilled positions such as carpenters, and there were subcontracts for drywall and carpentry. I mean, there were certainly skilled provisions that were being provided by this contract. And even a day laborer has to have some kind of training in basic instruction on safety, on what is safe and not safe to do on a construction work site. And so if you're going to be entitled to mechanics lien, you need to be assuming the legal responsibilities of an employee. And that's first that you take an interest in that employee. You make sure that they have the knowledge to do the job. You make sure they have the safety training to do the job. This court has held in scores of decisions that an employer has responsibility to provide a safe workplace and to provide adequate safety training to his employees. And so what I think this court ought to do is come in and get some definition for these seven factors that guide the trial courts or the fact finder to determine, are they really acting as a responsible, normal employer would in this situation? I mean, the facts in this case, I mean, it's almost a sham. The evidence is undisputed. All Advance did in this case was it did some recruiting, ran some newspaper ads, helped wanted ads, brought the people in, collected some general information, and then sent them to Gonzalez, the contractor, and left all the hiring and qualifying and interviewing to the contractor.
But it pays them.
It is, but how does it pay them?
But it pays them, and so if the purpose of the lien statute is to ensure that the person who works on the job gets paid, then if they get stiffed by the subcontractor, the workers aren't going to get paid.
Oh, well, no question. I'm not saying that the workers don't get paid. If they went out there and worked on the project, they get paid. The question is whether the temp agency is truly the employer and it's assumed the responsibility. The only question here is whether the temp agency gets paid.
Well, I understand that the temp agency is paying the employee.
Right.
And so if the temp agency doesn't get paid, employee doesn't get paid. Presumably. I mean, if somebody...
No, that's not correct. All the employees in this case were paid. There's not one employee that wasn't fully paid.
The risk of not getting paid is on
Then I agree. I'm not contending that the guy that was actually on the job and did the work could assert a mechanics lien. Okay. But the question is whether a temp agency was primarily providing financing and human resources. You know, have they taken on...
Can the right to that lien be assigned?
Can the lien be assigned?
Can the lien be assigned? Is it Lynn or lien? Professor Byron Davis from South Texas College of Law said it's lien. And I hear everyone pronounce it lien.
I've always called it lien, but I think probably both are correct.
Okay. I'll check with him on that. Okay. But can that right be assigned?
I don't. I assume it can, like any other contract right, but I don't know. I really haven't researched that issue.
So if Gonzalez wanted to sign its LIN here, then the temp agency could have filed a mechanic's LIN, and then the surety bond would have paid, or would there be another argument?
Well, you still have to meet the statutory requirements. I mean, you have to. I mean, I think every court that's looked at this, you have to look at what's really going on and apply a fact-intensive standard and test to find out whether labor is really being furnished.
But you just said the employee of the agency who furnishes the lien could file a lien.
Yes.
So Joe Smith files a lien.
Right.
And assigns it to the temporary agency. That would be okay.
I think it would.
How does he have a contract?
How does he have a contract?
With the general or the owner. Isn't that required?
No. Not to. I mean, it's still a sort of lien, and that's the beauty.
And the person furnishes the labor under a contract with the owner or the subcontractor?
I'm sorry? What's your question?
Section 53021 of the property code says a person has a lien if, and one of the requirements is that the person furnishes the labor under a contract with the owner's agent or subcontractor or some other people. How does
yes.
the employee have that contract?
Well, he has a contract, say, in a typical situation with a contract, subcontract, or with a contract.
No, the employee of the temporary agency. Yeah.
He'd be providing services under the contract between the agency and the sub.
That's right. I mean, I think the decisions in this area say there doesn't have to be privity of contract with the owner. It has to be under a contract. I mean, that's another alternative argument that I make, is that basically what does this requirement under a contract mean? And I submit that a reasonable interpretation of the statute is that you have to agree to perform some part of the owner's construction contract.
So the way around
and that's
this...
another reason, you know, why... Excuse me.
So the way around it then would be for the temporary agencies to put in their contracts with their employees. Any lien rights you may have from furnishing labor on the job are hereby assigned to the temporary agency, and then the agency could file a lien.
Your Honor, I just haven't given enough thought to know whether that would work or should work in this situation. But
further questions? Thank you, Counselor. Your time's expired. And the court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
The court, Mr. Wade, will present argument for the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I am just thrilled as I can be to be here. I've been doing this 21 years and I'm finally from the Supreme Court. Thank you for your time and consideration this morning. To answer your question first, Your Honor, as Justice Heck pointed out, for the employee of the temp agency to have lien rights to assign to the agency, there has to be some string of contracts to the contractor and to the owner. You have to be provide labor or materials under a contract with an owner or a sub, a contractor or a sub. So the only way the laborer has liens, if he's under a contract with a sub, for the agency to be a sub, it has to have a contract with a general or with a sub, so it would then have its own lien rights by virtue of itself being a subcontractor. So if the agency does not provide labor, then it can't have a subcontract that allows its workers to have lien rights. I'm reminded of the old story about the guy whose suit doesn't fit, and he goes to the tailor, and the tailor says, well, just pull one arm in and stick the other one out and walk with a limp. And so he's going down the street and passes a couple, and the husband says, man, I wonder what happened to that poor devil. And the wife said, well, I don't know, but doesn't his suit fit nice? The petitioners want the court to say, okay, we'll ignore the limp, we'll ignore the arm, you know, but we'll make the suit fit. And fortunately for I want to commend the court on City of Keller, which I think is a phenomenal opinion. I think it's the kind of comprehensive contribution to our jurisprudence that's uniquely within the province of this court versus the legislature. And
Oh, come on.
it's very true. It's a wonderful...
That's
it's
enough.
Making logic out of what is so counterintuitive, and I'm grateful for that. But what the Court of Appeals in this case did was almost predict what City of Keller would tell it to do. It looked at the evidence, and it said, given this evidence, given the undisputed evidence, given the undisputed inferences have to be drawn for that evidence, the facts can only be read one way, and that is that Advanced Temporaries provides labor. It's not a staff. It's not what we call staff leasing. It's not an administrative service. It's a provider of labor. And so if it's a provider of labor, the plain meaning of the statute gives it lien rights.
But don't you have to get beyond that and get to the control issue and a contract? And
well, if we start with the statute says anyone who provides labor or materials. Now, for purposes of the plain meaning of the statute, there's no distinction between one who provides labor and one who provides materials. And when you look at the control question, I think by analogy, the easiest way to look at this is how would it be any different if the sub had gone to the job site and dropped off 18 pallets of bricks. He has no control over what's done with those bricks on the job site. And the state's jurisprudence is clear that he doesn't have to. He doesn't even have to prove the bricks actually got used in the project. He can't do that. He's given over control when he's left the bricks at the job site. Same for shingles, same for pipe. But if somebody calls a material man and says, I need supplies, and he provides supplies to the job, he's done all he has to do to have a lien claim. And there's
but
no...
Do you think that he does not have a lien claim if he provided those supplies to an intermediary who then provided them to the job site?
You have to have it under a contract with a contractor or a subcontractor.
With respect to that job.
So if the contractor hires a framing sub and the framing sub goes and buys doors and the door supplier goes and gets hardware and the hardware provider can trace his hardware, the hardware is provided for a contract to do the doors for that job into that project, the guy who makes the hardware has a lien claim. And this delicate matrix of risk assumption that they talk about.
That statement you just made.
Yes.
Is that your argument, or are there cases that support that?
There's certainly cases that support that, Your Honor. And the Court of Appeals mentioned several of them in their opinion, talking about how, you know, if there's a risk of nonpayment down the stream, the risk is ultimately borne on the contractor because he controls the contracting on the job. If he wants his subs to put up bonds, he can make them put up bonds. If they didn't want to take the risk of Gonzalez's insolvency in this case, they could have made Gonzalez bond his ability to do the work. They didn't do it. They could have monitored him. When Gonzalez turns in a pay request, he's got to fill out a form that says all of my suppliers have been paid. Whether they police that or monitor that, that's within the control apart from the downstream subs. One of the questions that was asked about the contractor being able to make a claim against a sub downstream if there's defective workmanship is something that has become problematic. And what happens now in your standard AIA contract is a lot of times the sub will assign any cause of action he has against his subs to the one he contracts with, so that if in my example a minute ago, if the framing sub hires the door guy, and the door guy goes and buys bad doors, and the door guy says, I'm not going to go after my supplier, those claims can all be assigned upstream so the general can leapfrog those he's in privity with. But that's all under contract. That's not anything to do with the statutory rights to a mechanics lien.
Do we need a seven-factor test to figure this out?
I'll tell you where the seven-factor test comes in, Your Honor. We've got a traditional dichotomy here that once upon a time, lenders who loaned money on construction said, hey, we're providing the ability to buy the labor materials. We ought to have a lien claim. And the courts have said, no, you're not providing labor materials. You're just providing financing. And so as our economy has evolved, we've had this concept called staff leasing come about. And it's separately provided for in the labor code. It's funny, when the court granted the petition, I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about construction law or employment law or standards of review. But what's happened is that we've got these staff leasing companies, and they're specifically referred to as professional employer organizations in some of these cases. Now, by definition, they are presumed to provide administrative services. They're basically just
a payroll processor. And where the seven-factor test is most applicable is, and what the Court of Appeals here said, is that not all PEOs or POEs are alike. So I would suggest to the court that if you were a staff leasing company and you could show that you did more than just process payroll under that seven-factor test, you did supervise the work, or you did be actively involved in recruiting the workforce, or you did do more than just be an off-site bookkeeper, then maybe you could qualify yourself as providing labor. Because what we're looking at is the property code says provides labor. And so the courts have said, okay, if, how do we determine whether or not a temp service provides labor or just performs services? Now, in our case, you look at what Advance did and what our legal role is as an employer, and we're a labor provider. There's no reason for us to have to shoehorn in to a seven-factor test or any other factor test because we're providing labor. Now, you may have somebody that's more like a financier that would not be it may not be naturally apparent that you're providing labor, and you may then say, well, wait a minute, look, I do more of these things, you know, I ought to have a shot to get to the lien laws, which are liberally construed if I can get there. But for us, and it's funny because the AGC brief wants to draw a test in a way that would exclude the people that are intended for the statute to cover, and you know, they want to say, one, you have to have a license. Well, the only people that have licenses in Texas are staff leasing companies who, by definition under the case law, don't provide labor. And so then you would exclude the people who do provide labor, and you would exclude the people who have licenses. So they're clearly trying to create a situation where providing labor and providing materials get treated differently, and the legislature has not authorized that. It was interesting that my colleague got up a minute ago and essentially said, the Court of Appeals in this area haven't made enough law. You know, we've got seven-factor tests, but it's not thorough enough. It's not extensive enough. We need more factors. We need clarification on the factors. And we all know that the court, we don't want the court to make law. We want the court to apply the statute. The statute says anyone who provides labor has a lien claim. Did Advance provide labor? Yes, it did. And the Court of Appeals did a good job of saying, look, if you look at all this evidence, you can't come to any other conclusion as a matter of law but that Advance provided labor.
If you just ran ads, would that be enough?
Sir?
If you just ran help wanted ads, would that be enough?
Well, if you just ran help wanted ads, nobody gets to the job site. Something has to be done to get a worker to the job site. How did the labor? If all I did was run ads in the newspaper, nobody's going to the job site.
What if you go pick up a group of day laborers from some camp? You got, you know, 50 guys out there, and you go to some building project and say, I've got 50, you want 10, he takes 10, and he pays you, and or they get paid. I mean, what control is that? I mean, you're just transporting people.
Well, back again, it would be no different if I knew that they needed some Tyvek, and I said, hey, I know a job over here that's got some extra materials. I'm going to go over and see if I can buy some Tyvek and bring it to your job and sell it to you. You know, I'm providing the materials to the job. I'm providing the labor to the job. If I'm the one that's legally obligated for the materials I provide or for the labor I provide, then I'm the one that has the lien claim. And that's what the CLM case out of California says, is that we're looking at the legal relationship between the employer and the worker. Do they have the legal responsibilities of an employer? And in this case, they do. We're paying their payroll, we're paying their FUTA, we're paying their SUTA, we're processing them, we're making sure they've got their I-9. We're taking time cards, they're turning in time cards to us, and we're keeping their time, we're running their payroll, we're tracking their overtime. In this particular case, there was evidence that once Mr. Gonzalez was terminated, a bunch of those workers, we staffed on other jobs. Mr. Gonzalez may can say, I don't want these guys on my job anymore, but he can't fire them as our employee. Our employee.
All the workers here were paid. Is that correct?
All the workers here were paid. Right? I mean, you know, essentially, our inventory is personnel. And we do it with construction people. We do it with nurses. We have a roster of nurses. Hospitals call up, say, send us some nurses. We're farming out people just like other people in this industry farm out materials.
However, in this case, you disclaimed responsibility for the quality of the work, unlike an employer.
Well, We haven't disclaimed responsibility for the quality of the worker. And
of the worker?
Of the worker. If our contract with our client says that if they're dissatisfied with a worker, they can send them back within 2 hours and they get no charge whatsoever. If we're sending people out that are not suitable, you don't have to keep them. Just like if I deliver a load of lumber that you want number twos and I sent you number fours, you can reject delivery of the goods. But once you take that lumber, if you then put it into the job and you don't like the way it got built into the job, I can't be responsible for what your people did with my lumber, just like I can't be responsible for how your supervisors directed the work of my workforce. So I'm responsible for the qualifications and the capabilities of the persons I put on the job. But I'm not the one. It's just like, and we run into this, one of the cases that's come up is this St. Joseph's Hospital versus Wolf. The hospital may employ the surgeon, but they can't tell him how to do the surgery. They can't direct the details of his work in that regard. They can direct when his shift is and who he sees and these types of things. And the court has said, well, just because he's the barred servant, just because he's an employee for personnel purposes doesn't mean that the barred servant doctrine would apply. And even the city of Keller, the court recognized that distinction, which would be what Your Honor would be saying. The workers, once they're there and they're under the control of the client, then we can't be responsible for how their work is performed.
So you're both like an employer and unlike an employer.
In certain respects, now in terms of the, and I think the court's aware that the Department of Labor has one definition of employment. The IRS has another definition of employment. Texas workforce has another definition of employment. Barred servant has another definition of employment. And you may or may not be an employer under any one of those various definitions. In this case, but for the definition of a barred servant, we would meet the employer test in every other facet. The IRS is going to look at us as the employer. Workforce is going to look at us as the employer. We're providing their unemployment insurance. Department of Labor is going to look at us as their employer. If they don't get their time and a half, we're the ones who are going to have to go down and deal with wage and hour division. The only area that we're not, and so remarkably, the Association of General Contractors says the only factor that ought to matter is whether we control the details of their work, which has no basis in any of the jurisprudence that exists whatsoever, and certainly isn't within the definition of the statement of the property code. And were that adopted here, then once again, how would you transfer that over to materials? If you said that what was critical was controlling the details of the work to have a lien claim for an employer, then how would you comparably make the same transition for the provider of materials, because the statute treats them equally. The statute makes no distinction between providers of labor and providers of materials.
What do you, probably calls for speculation on your part, but what do you think caused the trial judge to rule that you simply provided financing and didn't really provide employees?
The argument that was made at trial, and is in some of the briefing at the Court of Appeals, was that implicitly the property code as derived from the Constitution only was intended to include providers of labor or materials that are in the construction industry. Basically, unless you were kind of an industry player, it was not contemplated that you could have these rights. And I think the trial judge simply accepted that argument, and because advanced business is not construction. It's some of what we do. We provide labor. And we argued that that's not what the property code says, but that was essentially, if the court wants my opinion, that's what it would be. Briefly, on the handout that we were given from the petitioner's court. Oh, and by the way, I also, one of the things I thought may have concerned the court in granting the petition in this case was to see how what we have suggested here, or how what the Court of Appeals has done, would harmonize with other states. And I didn't know how significant that would be. So I handed out a chart this morning where I listed the cases that are in the principal briefs. And basically, with the exception of one or two, which are easily explicable, easily explained to me, whether the lien claims are allowed dovetails exactly with whether or not it's a professional employer organization. The exceptions are the skilled staff case out of Colorado, which has a statutory definition that does not include what the Texas statutory definition does, and the on-site case, and in that case, it basically held that the provider of the labor did not have the kind of contract that requires by the statute there, which would be distinct from what we have. We clearly have a contract with a subcontractor. But also on my chart, I added a new case, a Kansas case that's earlier this year, that also held that a traditional labor provider like Advance did have a lien claim in that Kansas opinion. But with regard to the handout that we got from the petitioner this morning, I just want to clarify that I was able to quickly, on the backside under Factor 6, they make a reference to Reported Record Volume 4, pages 28 to 30. And the implication from the handout is that testimony is about this particular job, but the testimony at pages 28 to 30 was about another construction job for another contractor. It was not about Mr. Gonzalez here. Also, on there's a reference to page, 43, I think it's under his factors 3 and 4, he says there's no evidence that Advance made any affirmative representation to the workers that it was their employer. There's evidence in the record that the employers came in and filled out an application with Advance, that they turned in their time cards to Advance in order to be paid. There was also one other point I wanted to clarify about this on the reference to, it said back under that factor 6 where it says, when the company sent the temporaries back to us, that was the end of that. That also is a reference to a different construction job. As I said earlier, the evidence with regard to Gonzalez is that once he was fired from the job, some of these employees went to work for the contractor that replaced him, bringing up questions about, well, how dissatisfied could they have been with the workers themselves if they kept them on with the replacement sub, and also that there were other workers that did go to work on other construction projects that we had developed clients with at the time. The testimony about the Frontier case, which is referenced here, was basically that when that was terminated, there wasn't any other construction work to send the people to at that time. So I didn't want the court to get the wrong impression from what was put in this handout here. I think I've hit my punches. If there's any other questions, I would be happy to address them. As I indicated, I'm absolutely thrilled to have a visit with you all, and I look forward to your decision.
Was it worth the 21-year wait?
Sir?
Was it worth the 21-year wait?
The first time I went to the Fifth Circuit, and they started asking questions based upon not saying, you know, Counselor, what's this case about? It was such a relief to get in and talk to people that were prepared. So, yeah, I always love appellate argument because it's fun to have a dialogue, and I enjoy that immensely, as I guess you can probably tell. So absolutely, sir. I'll be thrilled to do it again. Thank you.
John, first I'd like to address your question. You asked, why do you think the trial court made a specific finding that Advance did not furnish labor in that case? Let me tell you why I think the trial court made that finding. I think it looked at substantial evidence in this record that basically all the recruiting and hiring decisions, and in fact, Gonzalez actually set the employees' wages. All Advance did, which is tack on a surcharge, it's an surcharge. The only way that Advance acted like an employer in this case was that it did some recruiting and did the payroll and did some of the human resource services. But all the important things that this court has recognized is important for whether someone's an employer, especially in the area of tort liability and the area of contractual liability, is control and supervision. Is the employer involved in disciplining the workers? Is it involved in training the employers? There's no evidence in this case that Advance did any of this. And also, the court needs to clarify the sixth factor, which is whether the temporary worker remains in the employment of the agency. Sure, they may have a contractual right to assign them to other jobs, but the court needs to go deeper and find out whether they actually continued in the employment of the agency. In this case, it was real clear that Advance didn't have any significant construction worker. And when the job ended, they basically the advanced person testified that was the end of that. There wasn't a job. And, in fact, what's demonstrated is several of these advanced employees immediately went to work for the subcontractor that took over for Gonzalez while he was after he was fired.
How do you treat the argument that we should treat employees in this situation the same way you treat materials? As long as they're furnished to the job site and perform the work, it's the same as if you provided the wood or the door to the job site.
Well, in that case, clearly, if your materials is being used to improve a job site in particular, you ought to be entitled to a lien. But if you're not actually furnishing the labor, employing the person that's providing the labor, you're just providing financing services and providing human resources service, you shouldn't be entitled to a lien. You ought to assume the full legal responsibilities that a subcontractor would assume in this situation. And, Your Honor, I now understand your question and concern. You don't want to interpret this statute in a way that leaves the workers that are recruited by the temporary employment agency out in the cold where they can't assert a lien. Well, what I think the seven-factor test does, if properly applied, what it does is it identifies who the true employer of the worker that's out there that's doing the test. And when properly applied to this case, it is abundantly clear that the employer in this case was Gonzalez, the contractor, not advanced temporaries. It's because, let's assume in this case the worker hadn't been paid, you know, they would be an employee of Gonzalez who had a contract with the contractor, and they would be entitled to a mechanics lien in this case. So I see my time's expired. Does the court have any additional questions?
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.